Good morning, everybody. Welcome back once again to Solomon on Blast here on Power Talk 1210. The power to think for yourself. If you are going to be away from your radio and you don't want to miss any of the show today, including the commercials, and believe me, you don't want to miss it today. You can stream us live, powertalk1210.com, or look us up on TuneIn Radio. And if you've missed a past show or want to share the show with somebody, all of the past shows, recent ones anyways, are on our website, solomononblast.com. The Solomon on Blast blog is also there with a great piece from Fred this past week, so check that out. Contains a lot of wisdom, knowledge, and understanding to see things more clearly in this confused culture of ours, because that's what the show is all about. And we want to hear from you guys, especially today. So give us a call during the show, 520-750-7456. Oscar's standing by diligently.
He's sitting by, ready to take your calls.
And we're going to have a special guest at the towards the end of the show, so you definitely don't want to miss that. But thank God we do have the power to think for ourselves and be able to express our thoughts openly in this great country. The problem is that unless we remain vigilant, I don't know what happened there, vigilant in maintaining the rights we have, somebody will come along and try to usurp those rights and take them away. A gentleman by the name of John Philpot Curran's statement was, "The condition upon which God has given liberty to man is eternal vigilance. Which condition, if he break, servitude is at once the consequences of his crime and the punishment of his guilt." And I'm sure you guys have all heard that quote, or at least the somewhat modified version that's attributed to Thomas Jefferson. The price of liberty is eternal vigilance. But really, it was written long before that, and everybody's modified it since then, by Solomon, of course, through the wisdom that God gave him. Specifically, Proverbs 12:24, Solomon says, "The hand of the diligent will rule, but the lazy man will be put to forced labor." So everything does lead back to what Solomon has written. The problem is we can get pretty distracted with lots of other things and not maintain our vigilance, but by our very nature, we're lazy and always looking for the easy way out. That way we can go out and play, right? And remember that when you were a kid, "Mom, can I go out and play?" At least when I was a kid, that was the question. Then the response was either, "Is your homework done?" or "All your chores done? Did you take out the trash?" But the culture we live in today is driven in large part by that same mentality. Sports, entertainment. You know where we're going with this, right? Yeah, it's Super Bowl weekend. What else in the world is going on? Absolutely nothing, right? Obviously, it's all about the Super Bowl. So in light of that, and because this station is a sports station, home of the Phoenix Suns, Arizona Cardinals, who should have been in the Super Bowl playing the Patriots, we're going to use Solomon's wisdom to look at all the things associated with what's going on in the NFL, the Super Bowl, everything associated with the big game, because there are restrictions on what you can and can't say and how you're supposed to say it with regards to that. Because everything's licensed by the NFL. And Proverbs 12:27, Solomon also says, "The lazy man does not roast what he took in hunting, but diligence is man's precious possession." But he also says there's nothing wrong with enjoying life. So we're going to look at both sides of the picture. You know, there's the bad, the good, bad, and the ugly. Well, we're going to look at all the sides of it. Because Solomon's wisdom even supports that aspect of it, of enjoying it. Ecclesiastes 8:15, he says, "So I commended enjoyment, because a man has nothing better under the sun than to eat, drink, and be merry," which I think a lot of people will be planning on doing tomorrow, "for this will remain with him in his labor all the days of his life, which God gives him under the sun." So it's okay to enjoy the fruits of our labor. Of course, there has to be a balance, though, and enjoy what God has given us. It's when we go to the extremes that we have the problem. Well, look at that. We'll be right back. We're back with Solomon on Blast with our first story here. In Proverbs 10:9, Solomon says, "He who walks with integrity walks securely, but he who perverts his way will become known." And, of course, everybody knows the lead story into this whole Super Bowl the past 2 weeks is all about deflating footballs, right? There was a news conference yesterday with Roger Goodell on Deflategate investigation, Kraft relationship, and the NFL's integrity. He, in this over a 48-minute news conference, some of the statements he's made, he says, on the issue of footballs used in the AFC championship game, Ted Wells and our staff have been hard at work conducting a thorough and objective investigation. As you would expect, we take seriously anything that potentially impacts the integrity of the game. We are focusing principally on two questions. Why were some football used in the game that were not compliant with the rules? And was this the result of deliberate action? So what do you think, Fred?
Well, I will speak unofficially.
Start over. Now your mic's on.
I will speak unofficially as a lifelong football fan from being a kid, which means I've been absolutely saturated in this stuff probably for too much of my life. So it's kind of second nature, but I'm going to give you an analysis here, Doug. See, all things being equal, teams messing with the ball is probably a lot more commonplace than people would just know. The problem is that the rule book says you can't do it. So that's the little dilemma in all of this. Going back, Brad Johnson, he was the quarterback for Tampa Bay back in 03. He said that the balls are too slick. He literally paid somebody a few $1,000s to scuff them up so they could get a better grip.
Okay, makes sense.
Makes sense, and they're too slick. And the only issue is that it's in the rule book not to do that. Okay. Now, the problem is, for anyone that's been following this for any length of time, knows that it would, like I said, if all things were equal, it probably would just go away. However, the New England Patriots, Bill Belichick, and also Tom Brady, I have to include in this, have a reputation that goes before them.
You got to be careful because the station manager, Jim Parisi, is a Patriots fan. We might get kicked off the station here.
That's right. So if they don't unplug the, now's the time to unplug the broadcast. So, you know, you have to go back to maybe 2007. It was called Spygate.
Yep.
And I had to go back and read a little bit more about that. I remember when it came up and you kind of, but what I was really surprised by is that they fined Bill Belichick $500,000, which is the maximum fine that you can hand out at a time like that. The maximum fine.
Okay. Which doesn't seem like a whole lot if you're really talking about these guys that are making $10-15 million.
Yeah, but apparently, well,
or more.
But apparently, whatever they did was serious enough. They also forfeited their first round draft pick in 08. So that's pretty serious stuff. So now what you're dealing with is the question mark and whether or not the Patriots have a culture of trickery in their locker room. So that's the question. Now, I think the more interesting issue was the week before, actually, in the divisional round, where John Harbaugh, the coach of the Ravens, accused the Patriots of using trickery in their substitution patterns.
Oh, right. Yeah, because they ineligible man or
yeah, you have to go to the referees and you have to check in and whatnot. Right. And they weren't giving the defense, which is really kind of protocol, the opportunity to adjust. And so they went to the back of the rule book and they were not able to prove that that was illegal. So the Patriots were happy about that. They found something in the back page of the book, you know, that enabled them to do their thing. But I mean, what I'm saying is, though, because of their previous reputation, this is the kind of stuff that sticks to Belichick and the Patriots. And let me just add one more to this. They asked Tom Brady if he knew anything about the balls, and he said no. Which, again, they will all tell you, even though this happens all the time, anytime it happens, it's because the quarterback himself personally supervises it. Because he's the one who is most concerned about how the ball feels.
Right.
He's the quarterback. He's running the show. Everybody said Troy Aikman, John Madden. I mean, anybody who weighed in on the subject said that's ridiculous. There's no way in the world that ball's going to be messed with in the slightest way unless the home team quarterback is aware of it. That's how it goes. So you have here this, again, it's kind of a reputation of where you get the feeling that these guys are up to some trickery and deception.
But is that any different than any of the other teams that are out there? I mean, it really boils down to what we talked about. There has to be integrity, like Solomon says. Otherwise, you are going to be found out. Now, maybe in some cases the people didn't get found out and they got away with it, or so they think, but now everybody knows about football pressures, right? How many people really understood the rules associated with the pressure in a football?
Well, here's where we get back to Deflategate. Again, you know, in and of itself, it's probably not that big of a deal, but when they're trying to use the rule book to trick somebody, and all of a sudden now the rule book's against you, well, the rule book doesn't matter. And let me take one more last shot here, and I'll leave Jim's team alone.
He hasn't called in and cut us off yet, has he, Oscar?
The 2002 playoff game between the Raiders and the Patriots has a famous play in it. The tuck rule play.
Yeah.
So
it's in the rule book.
It's in the rule book, but here's a situation that precedent-wise, in other words, all 16 games prior to that, 16 weeks of games prior to that, that play that would have been called a fumble. It's ruled a fumble on the field. This is the play that made Brady famous and got the Patriots into the Super Bowl eventually. That it was a fumble by everybody's standard except the guys in the booth, who looked to the back of the playbook, and they called it the tuck rule, and they gave the fumble back to the Patriots, which enabled them to score and win the game, whereas the Raiders would have just run out the clock and would have moved on in the divisional playoff round.
But the book was good to them in those days. Well, the one thing that seems to be kind of a common thread here is it all boils down to the officiating, though, right? I mean, somebody's making these calls, and I would expect this the officials, either on the field or the ones that are up in the booth, they're totally independent of whatever team they're officiating. So why would it be specific to the team, or why would they be making these different
types of
calls?
Well, this is where it gets the conspiracy theorists rolling here.
Okay.
The problem with this call, and I would also bring into play here, it's a good time to refer to the Dez Bryant catch a couple of weeks ago in the NFL playoffs. And trust me, there's no love lost with the Cowboys with me.
All right.
But the real question is that they had to not only make a ruling. Now, you can understand how a referee in a moment of time could make a ruling and not be correct.
Yep.
But on the field, it was going back to the Patriots game. It was considered a fumble. And then on the field, Dez Bryant's catch a few weeks ago was considered a catch. They literally had to overturn it. In other words, the status quo is the call on the field. You can't just say, I think it might look more like this. You have to have incontrovertible evidence that didn't happen. So this is where the conspiracy things start coming up. In other words, what's the common thread between those two teams that were ruled against in pretty amazing ways? And here's what I can only come up with.
It's
not the
conspiracy.
Referees. It's the owners. The Raiders had Al Davis, who had previously testified against the NFL. It was always considered a bit of a rogue.
Yeah.
And then Jerry Jones.
That everybody hated.
Yeah, he's definitely considered a maverick owner.
Yeah,
been fined
with the
by the league before for doing his own thing. Openly has criticized referees and been fined for that. Made some deals with some sponsors outside of the boundaries of the net. I think someone could make a case that the Empire strikes back against these guys, and that they are people that they have their ways of letting these guys know that you can do your own thing, but when push comes to shove, there are going to be situations that you're not very happy with. So that's just the.
your particular
opinion. I don't even know if it's my opinion. It's out there.
Oh, we have a caller, Oscar? All right. Who's on the phone? Hi. Welcome to Power Talk.
Anyway.
Who do we have, Oscar? We don't know. Go ahead, caller. You didn't give a name.
I took my call. I wanted to ask you about the Garrett Blunt. Certainly, the fact that he was caught with the corpus of a
You know what? You're cutting in and out. Your phone is really bad. If you want to try and call back in on, and get a better connection, but right now it's cutting in and out. We can't really hear you. All right. So anyways, I guess he'll try and give us a call back in, and then we'll take that call. But it really boils down to integrity. But how many of the fans are out there really understanding the rule book, know what the rules are, and are really looking for that integrity? Or is it, hey, I just want my team to win?
Yeah, I think most people just want their team to win, and that's kind of how it works. Getting back to the Dez Bryant catch, though, I wanted to point out that the defensive back for the Green Bay Packers, Sam Shields, came out this last week, the one defending it, and he said the catch should have counted. So that doesn't bode well for the NFL officiating crew to make a decision. And the opposing player who was actually defending the catch said that was a fantastic catch. And it really, and again, putting all my Cowboy prejudices aside, was probably one of the best catches in the history of the National Football League playoffs.
But it's going to...
It's sad that...
It's going to turn into just being a controversy, and it wasn't a catch, right?
Yeah, somebody's... it was ruled a non-catch. And I think Jerry got the message loud and clear.
You're not going to play in the Super Bowl this year, huh? Even coming from behind at the beginning of the year. So we got a break coming up. We'll take that break, and we'll be back with the next segment of Solomon on Blast. The dawning of the age of Aquarius. Age of Aquarius. Age of Aquarius. Wow, that's an old one. Back in 1969, one of the top songs of 1969. But it's not the Age of Aquarius anymore. But in this particular story, Bubba Smith, if anybody remembers him from Police Academy, well, he was a football player way before he showed up in those movies. And according to this particular article, he always alleged that the 69 Super Bowl was fixed. Pro football great Bubba Smith, who died in this article, was back from 2011 when he had passed away, claimed that for much of his adult life that the 69 Super Bowl between his Baltimore Colts and the New York Jets was fixed. And the Jets beat the heavily favored Colts in Super Bowl III in one of the biggest upsets in sports history. Now, we looked at things today. Has the conspiracy always been there, Fred? I think that's what we're looking at, right?
I think this conspiracy has been out there ever since the merger. And a lot of people don't realize that the American Football Conference and the National Football Conference basically used to be two different leagues. The National Football League, the bigger league, and the AFL was the smaller league. And they had kind of a war going on in the 60s. But they came together and they arrived at some kind of detente, and they decided that they were going to merge. But the big problem was that most people thought the AFL could not compete with the NFL, that it was kind of a...
The second stringers.
Yeah, it was contrived, and they thought that it was kind of a joke. In the first couple of Super Bowls that the Packers won, Vince Lombardi was downright condescending toward the AFL losing team. In his comments. And, you know, so it seemed like a bit of a joke. But suddenly in 1969, when the, I can't remember exactly, it was an 18-point differential for the gamblers, point spread, that the Colts were favored by 18 points, the NFL team, they were in the NFL at the time. Mm-hmm. Suddenly... Joe Willie Namath and the New York Jets
came in
after a guarantee by Joe, came in and upended the Colts and shocked the football world. And now, guess what? Going into the merger season of 1970, it had been proven that the AFL could compete with the NFL.
Right. You made the comment that Namath guaranteed it. 3 days prior to the game, he guaranteed that they were going to win, right?
Right. I won't even add to this that later that Namath had
ties to the mob.
been known for ties to the mob, where he had to sell his club in order to clear his name. But that we won't even go there. So the point that I think Bubba Smith was trying to make was there was a lot of very suspicious circumstances. Of course, it's all circumstantial.
Right. There's
but
no concrete
add
evidence.
To that, the quarterback of the Baltimore Colts at the time, a guy named Earl Morrill. The coach actually was Don Shula. That Earl Morrill was the NFL Player of the Year. And it could happen to anybody, but he had one of the worst games of his career on that particular day. You can go through some of the footage and you can see how he misses wide open receivers in the end zone to throw interceptions to Jet players and whatnot. So, who knows?
The conspiracy's been there for a long time by the looks of it. We'll come back after this commercial break with more of Solomon on Blast. Give us a call. We're back with Solomon on Blast here on Power Talk 1210. If you want to join us in our conversation, 520-745-7546. Get my tongue in order. Rainy days and Mondays. Well, it's a pretty rainy day out there today for us, right? In this next story, the question is, do rainy days and Mondays get you down if your church Super Bowl party is illegal? You'd have a rainy day and a blue Monday if your party is illegal. So what are the rules? Well, back in 2007, a church had received a letter from the NFL informing them that their planned Super Bowl party violated the copyright laws. The league, wanting more fans to watch at home and drive up ratings, objected to the church showing the game on a giant screen. As news spread, churches began to panic and cancel all of their events. After substantial backlash, however, the NFL amended their rules, and now they allow churches to show the Super Bowl regardless of the screen size, which, I mean, for nowadays, that's a big part of it. But there are rules in place, like playing on the field, with regards to what you can and can't do. Viewers cannot be charged admission, although donations to help with food or other costs can be accepted. And if a church holds their, quote, viewing party, because they can't use all of the NFL-licensed logos and everything else to claim it's a Super Bowl party, it's a viewing party, in their usual place of worship and does not charge a fee, the league says they will not object to the church having that party in order for the people that attend there to watch it. But if your church is one that rents a hall or has not a usual place of where you congregate, then you can't show it at that location. It has to be your usual place, a fixed building. So a lot of these churches that may be renting out of a strip mall or whatever, they're not going to be able to see it. So is this just part of the NFL out there harassing people for money? What do you think, Fred?
Well, I think you have to remember that the NFL is about money, and this colors a lot of the discussion that we've been having anyway.
Right.
And I do remember that case, and that, they ended up looking a lot like Scrooge, you know.
Yep.
Just some folks trying to get together and enjoy themselves. And so I think they made a pretty good adjustment to that. I think it's fair what they're requiring, and they seriously had to back off because in most cases, football fans probably do go to church. You know, you can't divide those two worlds, be making a big error. Like lots of American life, people always make that error to think that you can
separate
these things and these are different segments of society when, in fact, they're the same people.
Right, and I made the comment at the beginning, there has to be a balance, right? It's not all about being diligent on everything 100% of the time. There's got to be a little bit of enjoyment, and you know, and when you take that away from people, then there's going to be a lot of antics and a lot of backlash, like in this particular situation, especially when you start looking at the cost of what it takes to get into a game these days and how much people would have to spend. There was a article with the – now, I don't want to pick on you too much, but it is an article about the 49ers. So I know you're a big San Francisco 49ers fan, but this particular article says that because of that new stadium there, $1.2 billion Levi Stadium, it's now costing the family of four $641 just to go to a regular game. And that's the highest estimated price in the NFL for four people to attend a game. So the San Francisco 49ers lead that.
Yeah, well, you know, to me, the jury's out on a lot of what they're doing right now. When you run off, you know, a historically good coach, there's probably a lot of issues in that organization. But, you know, and this is the thing. When it is a business and it's about money, as fans, our sensibilities are offended when that comes to the surface. Yeah. But in reality, that's what it's always been about. And we just kind of get slapped in the face with it. We were having a discussion a while back about one particular play, talking about the 49ers a few years ago, by probably four seasons ago, or maybe three, when they had a Thursday night game against the Seattle Seahawks. In this game, the 49ers were already favored by a touchdown. In this particular game, at the end, there was a holding penalty on Seattle in their own end zone, which the rule says a safety is awarded to the defensive team. So the 49ers were ahead at the time 13-6. This would have given them a 15-6 advantage, receiving a punt now from Seattle. And Harbaugh, rather than receive the points, declined the points, and just simply decided to take the ball over on downs and run out the clock from that point instead of, you know, leaving an opportunity for an exchange to be made on a kick.
Right.
That seems like, okay. It's a night, you know, yeah. Game's over, whatever
it's
happened.
It's just a game,
it was
right?
A bad play on Seattle's part. Niners got the ball back. They do whatever they want to do. Here was the weird thing about that came to the surface that you really don't think about. They say on that particular game, that day, just one regular season game, that there was an estimated $150 million to $1 billion bet on that point spread.
Now, that's a pretty wide estimate,
yeah,
right?
It's a pretty wide estimate. So what I'm saying, even let's just call it $300 million. Yeah. Let's keep it to the low side.
What are we really talking about?
$300 million bet on the point spread of that game. So the Niners had to cover the spread of like a 7 to 8 point spread in order to win. In other words, if they would have had those extra points, the ones that bet on the spread in favor of the Niners would have won. When Harbaugh let those points go, the ones that bet against the spread won. So essentially, 2/3 of the people bet on the Niners, they said. So just to boil it down, $200 million changed hands over that little decision on a Thursday night regular season game by Harbaugh. That's scary when you think about the implications of money.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things. People more than willing to support their team, buy all the logo material and everything else, and you got to look behind the scenes. You lift the covers up on this thing, and maybe there's a little bit more to it than just a game where people are having a lot of fun and people like to play football. Maybe there's
that's some serious dough.
That's, yeah. And people die over less than that a lot of times.
Absolutely.
And when you look at all of these teams, Patriots actually was up on the top at $122 just for the a non-premium seat in the 2014 season. But this one from the San Francisco Giants, their premium seats range from $2,000 a seat to $80,000 per seat. So So there's more than just a game going on behind the scenes here. So we're going to take our quick commercial break, and then we'll come back with our segment One Greater Than Solomon. We'll be right back. We're back with Solomon on Blast, not Monday Night Football here. But we do have a special guest in our One Greater Than Solomon segment. On the phone with us is former Los Angeles Rams running back, color man for the UCLA Bruins, Rob Scribner. Rob, are you there? Hello, Rob. Doesn't sound like we have him right now. Rob? I think we're having some technical problems, maybe because of all this rain. He's going to call back, but I'll give a little background.
Rob Scribner played for the Los Angeles Rams during their really great seasons back in the 1970s. He was, before that, he was a running back on the great UCLA teams, and he has a great story to tell about his experience as a professional football player and what God did in his life as a young married man and some of his experiences. And I think he's with us right now.
Okay, let's see if we got him back on the line here. Good morning, Rob. Are you there?
I'm here.
Ah, much better, much, much better. Well, we really appreciate you joining us here this morning on Solomon on Blast. And we were just covering the whole Super Bowl weekend, discussing some of the issues that we are seeing out there with the NFL, and we thought you're the perfect man to weigh in and give us a little insight into what your history was with the NFL and your testimony.
Okay. I'm not sure what you guys have been talking about, but
all the problems.
Pardon?
All the problems. Deflategate, the money behind everything.
Yeah. Well, a lot of what's in the media usually isn't in the minds of the players. That's something that's the general public is really attuned to because it does sell tickets and that kind of thing. But what we were mostly involved with is the immediate players, just like a family is involved with family members. And it basically really overwhelms everything else. I think as far as testimony from
Well, let me ask you a quick question. I guess what you're saying there is that when, as a player, if you're going to be able to play at the level that the NFL requires, you've got to be focused on your responsibilities in your game.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you do your job, and the people that are listening, they do their job, and when they get into their job, they're pretty well focused. And our goal always was to go to the Super Bowl. As we started at the very beginning. As soon as the season ended, it started again, and we put our focus on that and did everything that we could to make ourselves ready for the moments when we played, and we wanted to be able to focus then. The sacrifice that the Rams would ask of any player was everything. You know, you have to be totally focused on this. And if they told us not to listen to the media, we didn't listen to the media. If they told us to weigh a certain weight, that's what we weighed, because we wanted to perform our best and not let down the other players on the team. It's a cloud. You're in that cloud, and anything that comes into that cloud, you're going to repel because you want to be your very best.
How did that affect you?
It overwhelms all your thinking, your family, your wife, your kids, everything. It's a tremendous sacrifice guys make when they go to play. At least it was then. I mean, today I think there's even more riding on some of these guys because of their financial implications. But you can only give 100%. You can't give 110. It doesn't exist.
Yeah. So how did it affect you personally when you were playing the game? Your family,
well,
your relationship?
Yeah, I was I was, you know, I signed for $12,500, which was the minimum wage in my day, and I think the highest paid player was $100,000. So
things have definitely
going back
changed.
At that point, I'd have to say that the first year was just a great thing to make the team. But once you made the team, you were in the Los Angeles Rams, and so wherever you went, which you went out to eat, you know, you were sometimes. If I was with other players, because I'm not the biggest guy, but if you're with somebody like Jack Youngblood or Merlin Olsen or Lawrence McCutcheon, some of those players that I played with, John Hadle, you know, people recognize them, so they're going to buy your dinner or they're going to do something for you. You get a good break on a car, and you're just different. And so you begin to see yourself as different. And you even think God sees you as different. You know, you're not really required to follow the things of the Bible because you're so special. And I think that in my second year really had an impact in my life, and I really backslid away from God. I hadn't really come to a place where I had the power of God's Holy Spirit in my life at that time. I knew He was there, but I didn't utilize it. And during the time between my first year and my second year, I backslid pretty severely and was really embarrassed by myself, and even came to the point where I wanted to take my life. And instead of doing that, I believe God intervened and spoke to me and said, if you don't want to live anymore, I'll take your life. And that was really the beginning of my real born-again spiritual experience. And things changed in 74, 75, how did that began to be a lot different.
How did that affect your playing and participation in the game?
Well, my next year was my best year at 75, and actually we were about this time that going into 76, the Super Bowl year, going into that, we lost the last game. We played Dallas Cowboys in Los Angeles, and we lost. In kind of a wild game, but if we'd have won that game, I'd have been one of the starting running backs in the Super Bowl. So, looking back on that, it was just a kind of just almost, and that would have been a big thrill, yes. But my better years were the years that I was dedicated to the Lord, and of course, since that time, it's been much better. My life is very full.
Yeah, and I can imagine that. Nowadays, it's even more difficult for these people, given that the amount of money that they're being paid, it's got to be even harder to keep your eye on what's important, which is God and Christ in our lives, especially when you see the level of media coverage that's happening out there on these things.
Mm-hmm. I think the issues are probably somewhat different as far as being able to be more focused. I think it's hard for players to, you can only give 100%. You can't do any more than that. And I believe our players, when we played, we wanted to do that, and we really were willing to sacrifice almost anything. I do think the pressure, though, what you're talking about is true. You know, you've got so much at stake for so many people, even though all of my family and people would come to the games, and people, you know, you wanted to play well for them almost as much as you wanted to play for your own teammates and the coaches. Actually, yourself would probably be the last. You just kind of take a deep breath and say, thank God the game's over and I didn't mess up too bad. And if we won, of course, we're all elated. But you're just trying to do your best. Every play, every opportunity you have, you try to do your best.
Right. Now, there's probably things that you did when you were playing the game that, you know, mistakes you made that to you are probably the biggest thing you remember, because we always remember our mistakes. We never hardly remember the good things we accomplish, right?
Correct. No question. I think in one of those playoff games, I had an assignment on a Statue of Liberty play to block a guy named Too Tall Jones.
Oh, yeah. Everybody remembers
for the Cowboys.
Him.
And there's a specific step you're supposed to take to make sure that he doesn't get a down angle. And I took the step a little bit too far out, and I just barely touched him, but it was enough. McCutcheon was able to make the play, but it was the wrong step. I'll never forget it. That was probably one of the worst plays. But at the same time, yes, you remember there were things you did wrong, and wish you didn't do it.
Hey, Rob, this is Fred. I've got a question for you. Going down memory lane, I think you told me one time about Alan Page, that one of the greatest All-Pro defensive ends, that you had a pretty good moment with him. And you want to tell us about that?
Well, the Vikings were a very strong team in those days. Fran Tarkington and Page and the rest of their team, but I was on the punt team. I was the captain of the punt team, and what they did was they tried to block a punt by coming straight up the middle, and the one guy that was he basically tried to take me out of the play, grabbed a hold of me, and the only thing that I could do when I saw Alan Page coming through is just reach out my arm and grab a hold of his the bottom part of his uniform, and so and that's how I brought him down. They pulled on me, so I pulled on them. So there's some things you don't see that go on in football.
not everything's seen by the refs, right?
No, Alan Page is not very happy at that point, and he made it known. And so, that's football.
So, what have you been doing the last 40 years?
Well, I've been a pastor of a church here in Santa Monica for the last 27 years, and before that I attended the church, and I've been in business and having 8 children, and 5 of those are married now, and I have 15 grandchildren, so I'm busy.
Yeah, that'll definitely keep you busy.
Yeah, it's been a real blessing. God's been very good to our family and in all ways, financially and everything, so... we have a lot of good friends there in Tucson. My pastor, Harold Warner, there at the Door Church, and Fred pastors there as well, and many of the other people that have helped me in my life have been my brothers and sisters in Jesus. I think that the number one institution in our country, and far outweighing the Sunday football crowd,
yeah,
is the crowd that goes to church and really does believe and follow what Jesus taught, because that's where our real blessing and reward comes from.
Right.
The reward is people.
Yeah, and that's eternal versus by next week there'll be another news story that'll overshadow the Super Bowl and nobody will be talking about it.
That's right. And all these footballs that I have for, play of the game, or, we got game balls, they're all deflated. and we don't throw them, or we don't do anything with them. But I know one thing, that they're not going to make it to heaven.
Right.
And all the trophies, and my kids have already destroyed them all. They were in the garage at one time. And mostly, all the things that we have here, just everything is just not going to be there. The people are,
right,
and they're the great treasure, and the treasure that we've been able to touch in Africa and France and Guatemala, places where we've planted our churches and gone. These are the real treasures, and they'll be there. People will be in heaven,
right?
And it's not just counting on it; they'll be there. That's what the world is sometimes missing, is all these things that are passing away, $80,000 or whatever they're paying for,
yeah,
Super Bowl tickets or days or weekends or whatever there at the Super Bowl. It will pass. Sure, there'll be joy that's associated with it, but it'll pass, and the real blessing is the people that you are able to meet and know and be with you for all of eternity.
Well, we really appreciate you joining us today, Rob. If you want to give a plug out, what's the name of your church and where is it specifically located?
Okay, our main church is, the Door Church there in Tucson is on Irvington Boulevard, and that's my pastor, Harold Warner, there. Our church in California,
yeah,
is in Santa Monica. It's called the Lighthouse.
Okay.
And it's near the corner of Wilshire and 20th Streets, our main church.
Okay. Well, we appreciate it again. Thank you very much, Rob, and okay. Enjoy the Super Bowl tomorrow.
I'll be in church.
That's a good answer. Thanks. Okay, so that pretty much wraps it up for this week's version of Solomon on Blast. We've got Jake Feinberg sitting out in the outer office waiting to come in. And coming around about 4 o'clock, you don't want to miss On the Menu Live with Matt Russell. He's going to be actually out at a restaurant, and I don't remember the name right off the top of my head. You might want to check that out if you're looking for some good eats. We appreciate everybody listening, and as always, until next week, think wisely.